want to talk to you this morning about our theme, Sufficient Servants. As I think about that theme, the obvious thoughts are how God takes us when we're not sufficient, makes us sufficient. We don't have the talent. We don't have the natural ability. Remember how 1 Corinthians 1 talks about he doesn't take, you know, the noble and the mighty and the wise. He takes the fools and the weak and the base, and he uses them to his glory. And so we understand how when we aren't capable, God makes us capable. When we're not sufficient in ourselves, he gives us the ability still to serve him. But my question this morning, can God take a servant who doesn't want to serve and make him sufficient? Can he take someone who doesn't want to do God's will and make him sufficient to serve him? Can he take you when you're in those moments of rebellion and you're a rebel and make you capable of serving him? Because we all have our moments, don't we, of rebellion. We all have those times when we know God wants something and we just don't want to do it. I remember there was a time in my life I was living with a woman who was not my wife. I was addicted to the bottle. All I could think of was my next drink. Very selfish, self-centered. Every thought was just about my needs. And if I didn't get what I wanted, I would sometimes literally scream. And then I turned 1 year old and had my birthday. You knew I wasn't quite that much of a rebel, didn't you? But I do remember a time, this is just a small taste of what we're going to talk about. I do remember a time I was out of sorts and how quickly God turned my heart from being a rebel to breaking me and bringing me back to him. I was probably about 10 years old. I was raised by a single mother who was raising three boys by herself. My dad had run out on the family when I was in the womb. And I knew my mom had the difficult task of being mother and father and working a job, and she was a teacher, and trying to raise us. And it was a challenge, and we were a challenge. She did a very good job, frankly, of raising us, so we were good kids as far as that went, but we had our times. And I remember one Easter, we were coming up to Easter, and I said something or did something, I don't even remember what it was, and my mother sent me to my room to bed without supper. And that was the evening we were going to color the Easter eggs. And it was going to be another year till we did that, right? You do it once a year. And I don't know what I did, but I probably said something. I probably sassed her, and off I went to my room. And I remember going in my room and slamming the door, which was not like me. I was a very mild child. And as soon as I did that, it kind of scared me too. And I thought, she's coming through that door, and she's going to kill me twice. She didn't, which surprised me. I must have eventually laid down, gone to sleep, still in my clothes, mad. I woke up in the middle of the night, hungry, and had to go to the washroom. So I remember walking out of my bedroom, and my mom's bedroom door was right across the hall. I came out, her light was still on, and I heard my name. And I went and peeked in the door, and there was my mother on her knees at the end of her bed, tears running down her face, crying out to God for me. Probably along the lines of, oh God, I've tried, I don't know what to do, I'm at my wit's end, help. Immediately, God took the weight of that woman's life and put it on my shoulders and broke me. Immediately. And I remember going in there, kneeling beside her, putting my arm around her, tears coming down my face. I'm sorry, Mom, I'm sorry, I'll never do it again, whatever it was. But I remember to this day how quickly I went from anger, because when I woke up in the middle of the night, I was still angry, And if I had met her in the hallway, I don't know what I would have said. And how quickly God just broke me and changed my heart. I want you to turn to the book of Jonah this morning. I appreciate very much during our missions conference Dr. Gary Anderson's messages on Jonah. It's always a challenge when you're a speaker and you know your date's coming and you worry somebody's going to preach my sermon before I get there. But I thought I was pretty safe with Jonah. And then until he started announcing, and I thought, okay, one message, and then he did three. But I do appreciate so much of what he said, and it confirmed for me a lot of what I had been studying and learning, and so that was a joy to just hear him as he opened this book. I'm going to come from a little different direction, and but you understand the story. If you look at chapter 1, we see in verse 1 of Jonah, the word of the Lord comes to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying, arise and go to Nineveh and cry out against it. So that was the challenge. That was the call. Arise, go, cry out. But we know what he did or what he didn't do. And so it says in verse 3, but Jonah. And he instead went toward Tarsus. But look at chapter 3. The word of the Lord came unto Jonah the second time, saying, arise, go to Nineveh, and preach, same word as chapter 1, cry out, same offer. This time, he does it. And my question is, what changed between chapter 1 and chapter 3? And the answer is the rest of chapter 1 and chapter 2. And we're going to look at chapter 2 this morning. How God changed his heart. What God did with this prophet. Along the way. And so we have three things we're going to look at. The story of Jonah, real quick. And then the song, which is chapter 2. Jonah writes a psalm, a song in chapter 2. And we're going to, from that, hear from his own words what God did. And then we're going to look at the strategy that God used to change Jonah and help him be willing and able to serve. So let's first look at the story. And we see the call of God there at the beginning in verse 2 to arise and call. And then we see Jonah's refusal. And then we see his descent. There's wording in here that has the image of going down. Notice verse 3, Jonah went down to Joppa. And then he went down into a ship that he had paid his fare to get. And then notice, if you will, in verse 5, once he's in the ship, Jonah was gone down into the sides of the ship. And then he lay down and he goes to sleep, which is the exact opposite of what God had asked him to do, to arise and go and cry, which are active ideas. And here he is just sleeping, the exact opposite. So he went down to Joppa, down into a ship, down into the sides of the ship, and he lay down. He's just opposite of what God had asked him to do as he could be. And then we see God intervening. As the ship goes out, there's the storm. It says in verse 4 that the Lord sent out a great wind into the sea. Literally, he threw it out there, just like when the sailors are going to throw Jonah in the sea. Same word. God throws a storm into the sea and intervenes. And then we see the exposing of Jonah's sin. In verse 8, actually in verse 6, Jonah hears an echo. God's call to him was to arise and cry out. And in verse 6, we see the sailors asking him to do the same thing. Arise, cry out. That had to ring a bell with him. And then in verse 8, we see them probing him. Who are you? What'd you do? And Jonah tells them in verse 10, what he did. He just let it out. Sometimes we think we have these secret sins, but God exposed him. And then he gets thrown in the water, but God rescues him. And that's the fish. And I appreciate Dr. Anderson also affirming that in his missions conference messages. The judgment wasn't the fish. And the rescue wasn't when he got on dry land. The judgment was the sea, when he's in the water, and the rescue is the fish, we're going to find out as we go through this. Because Jonah, in chapter 2, He's praying a prayer of thanksgiving for rescue, and he's still in the fish. You see, so the fish was his rescue. And then Jonah's response is going to be what we look at in chapter 2, and then Jonah's change of direction. So let's look at chapter 2, his song. It's going to start with a summary in verse 2, where he takes two lines, and he basically says, I cried out to God and he heard me. I cried out to God and he heard me. Notice chapter 2, verse 2. He says, I cried by reason of my affliction unto the Lord. He heard me. Now he's going to say it again. Out of the belly of Sheol or hell I cried, and you heard my voice. And then he gets a little more specific in talking about his distress, why he had to cry out. And he's going to say it twice. He's going to echo himself. The first time he talks about his distress in verse 3, he's going to take four lines to describe the trouble he's in once they threw him in the water. And I think in reading it, he's still on top of the water. And so notice verse 3, Thou hast cast me into the deep, in the midst of the sea. All the floods compassed me about. All thy billows and thy waves passed over me. So he's in this turbulent water, and there's still waves. You don't have waves under the water. So here's this waves and turmoil, and he's getting buffeted. So I think he's up there on the surface of the water, and he's in trouble physically. And he describes it in four lines, and then something switches in his mind, and suddenly he thinks about his spiritual distress. And he only takes one line to describe it, and that's at the beginning of verse 4. He said, Then I said, What? I'm cast out of thy sight. Here he's struggling to stay on top of the water and survive and breathe. And then all of a sudden he realizes, but I'm also cast away from God's sight. It's interesting to me that sometimes our physical distress, we're more aware of that than our spiritual distress. We think about it longer and more intently. That's why I think he uses four lines to talk about it. I'm up here struggling to get my breath. I'm in trouble. And then all of a sudden, the spiritual distress hits him. And once we consider our spiritual distress, it doesn't take us long to realize we're in deep trouble. And so here we see that happening with Jonah. And he's in this distress. Sometimes, as we're more aware of the physical distress, it does take us longer to understand that something more is going on, and we can't see past the physical distress to the spiritual. But once we do, quickly we understand. And notice his response then, once he understood his spiritual distress, in verse 4, he looked toward the holy temple. That represents God, the presence of God. So here he is trying to get away from God, and he's about as far as you can get, and he's out there in the ocean, and all of a sudden, this is the first sign that his heart has changed. He was not wanting contact with God. He was wanting to get away from God. And now, here we see him describing in the water the physical distress, and then as soon as he recognizes the spiritual distress of being cast out of God's sight, his heart changes. We'll talk about why that happened in a minute, but he cries out to God. He looks toward the holy temple, which is where God is. Now he's going to describe his physical distress again. He's going to go back and echo it. Hebrew writers like to do it this way. This time he uses five sentences to describe it because this one here is a little more intense. I think it's now describing the fact he has gone from the surface into the deep. He's sinking below the waves. He's sinking down to the bottom of the sea. The Mediterranean can be very deep. It averages about 5,000 feet down. It can go down 17,000 feet, over 3 miles, but probably he was near the shore because of the storm and because of the fact he's going to hit some weeds here. Notice verse 5, the waters compassed me about. So he's surrounded now by water. Even to the soul, literally the breath perhaps, same word. The depths closed me round about. The weeds are wrapped around my head. I went down to the bottoms of the mountains. And that was, to the ancient mind, that was the bottom of the ocean. That was where the roots of the mountains were. And now the earth with its bars was about me forever. And that was sort of the final understanding that I'm dying. And the idea of earth's bars, death's doors swing one way, right? And he said, I'm getting closed in now from a place I can't escape from. I'm dying. And so his physical distress, again, is described as now I think he is sinking below the water. He's cried out to God once. He's looked toward the holy temple, but he keeps sinking. But notice the end of verse 6, the rescue comes. Yet hast thou brought up my life from corruption, O Lord my God. I think this is the fish. I think this is when it happens. It sweeps in and rescues him, swallows him. And he knows he was just about to die. His breath was gone. And the surface was who knows how far up there. There's no way he's surviving. And all of a sudden this fish comes along. He's swallowed and he can breathe. Which is an amazing thing, isn't it? In the belly of the fish. It's interesting, too, the reversal that takes place here in the sense that he had been going down, down, down. Remember that descent imagery? And now what does it say in verse 6? God, you brought up my life. Everything's changed now. Instead of descending, he's rising. And so the God that had called for him to arise and go and preach now causes him to rise. And he makes it happen here. So this is a psalm of thanksgiving for a past deliverance here in chapter 2. He's describing from the belly of the fish the rescue that took place outside the fish in the water when the fish came along and rescued him from the ocean. So the fish is the deliverer. The description of Jonah's distress is involving an image of him descending not into the belly of a predator, but into the belly of the deep, of the sea. I think as he was sinking in the ocean, he really felt he was going to be separated from God forever. This was eternal judgment, eternal punishment. In the New Testament era, we understand concepts of grace in a way they didn't. I really think Jonah, as he was sinking into the water, as the earth's bars were closing on him, as he felt cast out of God's sight, he really felt he was going to be separated from God for forever. And then the fish comes and rescues him, and he's now face to face with God, but he's a prisoner. He's rescued, but he's not free. He's in the belly of this fish, and out of that he is giving thanks. And so then he gives a little summary in verse 7. When my soul fainted within me, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came to thee into thy holy temple. Again, the imagery of God's presence was even there in the deep of the ocean. He could not get away from God, thankfully. And then verses 8 and 9 are a commentary, ending with this great phrase, salvation is of the Lord. It's about the exact middle of the book. It's the great phrase of the book. God's salvation comes not just to Jonah. He doesn't just save Jonah, but he saves Jonah so he can save Nineveh. There's always a bigger picture in God's mind. He saves you so he can save others, you see. And so salvation is of the Lord. I'd like to go now and talk about the strategy God used here in turning Jonah's heart. We see the story. We see his psalm, his song describing how God changed his heart. But what was God's strategy? Number one, notice how God used circumstances. You see, God orchestrates our lives, and he opens our eyes to his involvement in our life. In chapter 1, verse 4 of Jonah, it described God sending the storm. In chapter 1, verse 17, he prepared a fish. In chapter 2, verse 3, Jonah recognized that God threw him into the deep, not sailors. God did it. And in that verse, he also says, Lord, it's your billows and your waves that have passed over me. So he sees God bringing these circumstances into his life, making him recognize how helpless he is. Understand this, young people. Just because you can choose does not mean you're in control, you see. Sometimes our bad choices take us down into a pitiable condition. Our bad choices also do not thwart the control of God over our lives. You can't run from God, as Jonah tried. But thankfully also, our bad choices do not remove us from the reach of God's mercy. I love that statement. You may have heard a long time ago. I just heard it recently. If you think you've blown God's plan for your life, rest in this. You, my beautiful friend, are not that powerful. Isn't that great? I love that. You cannot, by your bad choices, remove yourself from God's reach. Neither can you control your life just because you can choose what direction you go. Secondly, not only circumstances, but he used the exposing of his sin. And as he brought to light sin in Jonah, that set into play some events. And that's what will happen. You may think your sin will never be exposed. Your rebellion is secret. Nobody knows. They look at you, you're a good ABC student. Everything's fine with you and God. You know maybe in the depths of your heart you're a rebel right now to some degree. And you think you can hide that. But God exposes it. He does. Interestingly, often it's the sinner himself who finally fesses it up. Nobody catches you. Jonah just told them, it says in verse 10. He told them his sin. You may have a secret sin. You may have done it with somebody else and you made a pact. Nobody will ever know. It's just you and me. But you don't control that person. God may deal with their heart, bring them to a place of shame and guilt and confession. Then it'll be open. You can't control them. And you can't really even control you. Because God can bring you to a place of shame and guilt and burden where you just have to let it out. And you know that's the only way to relieve yourself of this guilt. And so it's exposed. It will be exposed. Be sure your sin will find you out. Right? Proverbs says, he that covers his sin will not prosper, but whoso confesses and forsakes it will have mercy. And suddenly that truth hits home to you and says, I've got to tell. Proverbs 28:13. Okay. So your sin will be exposed, and in the exposing, God will do things in your life. He'll use the shame. He'll use the guilt. He'll use the discipline. In the exposing of sin, sometimes discipline comes, and he uses that in Hebrews 12. So God worked on Jonah, and for Jonah, the judgment was the sea, and we see how quickly, I mean, we're talking about matters of minutes at most, maybe seconds, between a rebellious Jonah and a repentant Jonah, how quickly God turned him. Then there's the breaking point. God knew Jonah's breaking point. Jonah, he wanted to control his rebellion. He wanted to flee God's presence. He speaks about being cast out, though, driven from God's presence in verse 4. He sought for a descent that would only take him as far as he chose. A descent that left God behind, but not too far behind because he needed him. He wanted independence from God that he could control, but nobody is able to control their own rebellion. The path we take soon takes over us. The descent Jonah began became a slippery path that was accelerating at an incredible speed towards Sheol, and he truly felt as if God was pushing him down the slide faster and faster. But suddenly, just as Sheol opened its mouth for him and he could see right into its belly, deliverance came. And the fish, like the hero in an epic, swooped down and saved him at just the last minute. God was there after all. He was not enjoying Jonah's demise. And suddenly the language of descent is reversed and God brings him up from the pit because he cared. So God knows your breaking point. For Jonah, it was that moment where he understood God was abandoning me, it appeared. I was really going to die and be separated from him forever. And he looked to God and he looked to the temple. I don't know what your breaking point is, but God does. God can get your attention in a second. It could be a sound of a car accident or the cry of someone you love. It could be a sight. I remember how my wife and I, when our son was in the military in Afghanistan for two tours, we talked about if we should see a military vehicle pull in our driveway and an officer and a chaplain get out, we knew what that would mean. Our son was dead. A sight of something can change you in an instant. A sudden pain. Don't think because you're young, things can't happen like that to you. God in a second can change your life. He knows your breaking point. God can reduce you to helplessness in an instant and take you down to a place of despair. And if, like Jonah, you have removed God as a resource, you have no hope. But if you have left God as a resource, you have all hope. Ultimate hope. And that's the last thing God used with him. Somehow Jonah knew, even in his descent down into that ocean, God really wasn't abandoning him. He really was right there. And he turned to him. God was never out of the picture, never out of the way. He was always as close as a prayer, which is exactly what Jonah offered up. Because God can bring you to the point where all you think about is him. I'll call him George. It's not his name. He was in my first church in Mishawaka, Indiana. And he was about our age, in his early 30s. A wonderful young man, professional, engineer, lovely wife and family. But he had a secret sin. He was addicted to pornography, and one weekend when his wife was away at another city visiting her parents with the children, he got all worked up and he took it a step further and he went out on the streets of South Bend, Indiana and solicited a prostitute. You see, you can't control your sin and your rebellion. Thankfully, by God's grace, the prostitute was an undercover police officer and she arrested him, took him in. His first phone call was not to his wife, but to his pastor. I was the associate, and the pastor and I went and worked with him, worked with his wife. By God's grace, she forgave him. The family was reconciled. For the next 2 years, we mentored him. The church men worked with him, and he was very, very repentant, willing to be open and let God change his heart. And God did. After about 3 years, we left the church to go to the mission field. And I had trained George to take over the children's ministry that my wife and I had started. When we came back to visit the church a few years later, I went downstairs, and George was still there. And he was teaching the children, it was around Easter, he was teaching them the Easter story. And these were kids from 5 years to about third grade. And as he's teaching the story of the cross, all of a sudden he couldn't go any farther and he just was weeping in front of the children. And the children are probably like, what's this big man doing weeping? But I knew. And I knew that George had never quite gotten over how God, in his grace, through the death of his son on a cross, could rescue him. Dear friend, there is hope. If you're a rebel right now, there's hope. If you're fleeing God, not wanting even to serve him like he wants, there's hope. There's also a breaking point. But I trust that God won't have to take you there. Long before that breaking point, you will choose to look to God. Heavenly Father, you know every heart here. You know their offering of themselves to you or their withholding of themselves. Lord, you are able to take us in our rebellion. And Lord, you know how all of us have those times. And you can turn our hearts back to you. And in doing so, make us sufficient servants. And in saving us, you will save all those others you want to reach through us. Do that work in our hearts today. In Jesus' name, amen.